Welcome everyone to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence, Friday, January 30th, and this is the Macro Geopolitics Investing Evening Edition. I'm Maya, and alongside me as always is Alex.
Always a pleasure, Maya. It's remarkable how quickly January has flown by. You know what caught my attention this week? It's this feeling that we're approaching a particularly challenging crux, that pivotal point on an alpine climb where the route becomes exceptionally difficult, demanding a complete shift in strategy. It feels like that for markets and global power structures right now.
A crux? That's unexpected, Alex. But I get it. We're seeing AI disruption shaking things up and a noticeable market correction underway. Are we seeing the beginning of something bigger?
Precisely. And it's not just the markets. There's something fascinating happening with financial repression, forcing a reevaluation of traditional value investing.
I know, right? And the scrutiny of big tech, their market power, it's escalating. It's almost as if the tectonic plates are shifting.
Absolutely. It's intertwined with the geopolitical realignment, the undeniable sense of U.S. decline.
Let's not get too dramatic just yet. But you're right, it's all connected. And we'll wrap up tonight by diving deep into this potential commodity supercycle and the geopolitical drivers behind it. Let's dive in. So I want to start with something that's been rattling around in my head, and I think it's on everyone's minds, the AI disruption and the very real possibility of a market correction. We're seeing valuations that seem detached from reality. It's like we're all collectively holding our breath, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Alex, your thoughts?
It's a compelling observation, Maya. The current enthusiasm surrounding AI is in many ways unprecedented. The sheer volume of capital expenditure projected for 2026, that $1 trillion figure mentioned in the Long Gold and Long Stocks podcast, is staggering. But enthusiasm alone doesn't justify valuations. We're seeing a significant disconnect, as Katie Martin pointed out, between executive optimism and the reality experienced by frontline workers.
Exactly. It's almost like we've entered a phase of AI theater, companies implementing AI solutions largely to be seen doing so, rather than because they demonstrably improve efficiency or generate tangible returns. And that's a dangerous foundation to build a multi-billion dollar valuation on, isn't it?
It absolutely is. The core vulnerability, as highlighted in the Something Has Broken podcast, lies in those subscription revenue models. A coordinated, even a modest, decline in subscriptions, the unsubscribe February scenario they proposed, could trigger a cascade of negative consequences. It's a structural weakness that's being largely overlooked.
And let's not forget the broader economic context. The persistent underperformance of the U.S. market, masked by currency fluctuations, is a red flag. Foreign investors are diversifying away, as we heard in Something Has Broken, and the increasing frequency of what Ed Luce called TACO events, Trump-induced market disruptions, is eroding trust. It's not simply a sell America narrative, but a recalibration.
Precisely. The shift in asset allocation isn't just about avoiding the U.S. It's a recognition that returns are diminishing and that geopolitical risks, particularly those stemming from potential presidential actions, are being factored into investment decisions. It's a strategic repositioning driven by a more realistic assessment of risk.
The Bloomberg Intelligence piece on Microsoft dropping sharply highlights this perfectly. The slower cloud growth, despite massive capex, suggests a prioritization of long-term AI development, potentially at the expense of short-term profits. Investors are starting to question whether this spending is yielding the returns that were promised.
Indeed. And that's where we need to consider the broader market dynamics. It's a situation akin to a chess game. The current market sentiment is like a premature, aggressive pawn push, a lot of energy expended with potentially limited long-term gains. The tech companies are committing significant resources, but the board is far from settled. The real strategic advantage will accrue to those who can patiently maneuver their pieces, anticipating the opponent's moves and securing a more defensible position.
That's a brilliant metaphor, Alex. It really captures the strategic element of this disruption. It's not just about raw power, it's about foresight and adaptability. Now let's talk about the potential scale of this correction. The Something Has Broken podcast mentioned a potential 50-80% correction in major AI-driven tech companies. Do you think that's realistic?
It's certainly within the realm of possibility, particularly given the dot-com bubble comparisons. However, the key distinction is that Nvidia, unlike many of the dot-com darlings, is a profitable company. This suggests a layered structure, a froth of overvaluation sitting atop a foundation of genuine business value. We're more likely to see a selective correction, with some companies significantly impacted while others demonstrate resilience.
But the influence of these companies in market indices is undeniable. A significant correction in, say, Microsoft or Apple would have ripple effects throughout the entire market. And let's not forget the potential for systemic risk, as the podcast pointed out.
Absolutely. The interconnectedness of these companies amplifies the potential for contagion. And the narrative around Meta's AI investments, as discussed in the Bloomberg Surveillance podcast, further underscores this point. Investors are now assessing their spending in a more critical light.
The special encore What's Driving European Stocks podcast offered a fascinating counterpoint. European equities are breaking a decade-long discount range relative to the US, and AI adoption within Europe is significantly outperforming. Is this a sign of a broader shift?
Certainly a compelling trend, and the consistent outperformance of European equities in constant currency terms since the US elections is notable. However, the lower earnings growth in Europe suggests this may be more of a short-term rotation than a long-term structural shift.
What about the role of the Federal Reserves? The Long Gold and Long Stocks podcast highlighted a bimodal distribution of rate cuts, with a significant probability of 4 cuts if the labor market weakens. How does that factor into the equation?
It introduces a crucial risk factor. The market's expectation of 2 cuts might be overly optimistic. If the labor market falters, a more aggressive response from the Fed could exacerbate the correction, particularly given the sensitivity of tech valuations to interest rates.
And let's not forget the geopolitical element. The potential for a peace agreement in Ukraine that merely postpones the conflict could divert capital and talent to other regions, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of instability, as noted in Something Has Broken.
Precisely. Geopolitical risk premiums are already impacting investor sentiment, and any further escalation could trigger a flight to safety, benefiting precious metals and potentially accelerating the rotation away from U.S. assets.
So to summarize, we're seeing a confluence of factors, inflated valuations, a weakening dollar, geopolitical uncertainty, and a potential shift in Federal Reserve policy, all pointing towards a heightened risk of a market correction. The key is to be discerning, to differentiate between companies with genuine fundamentals and those built on hype.
Indeed. The chessboard is set and the game is far from over. The players are positioning themselves and the moves will be critical. We're entering a phase of increased volatility and uncertainty, demanding a more cautious and strategic approach to investment.
That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. What this really comes down to is a reevaluation of risk and a recognition that the era of easy money may be coming to an end. So let's dive into a fascinating and potentially unsettling topic, financial repression and value investing. It's a combination that hints at a specific historical context and a unique set of investment opportunities if you know where to look. Alex, what's your initial take on the concept of financial repression itself?
Well, Maya, at its core, financial repression describes a situation where governments manipulate the financial system to effectively transfer wealth from savers to borrowers, often through artificially low interest rates, inflation, or other regulatory measures. It's not necessarily a deliberate policy, but rather a consequence of policies designed to manage debt burdens, particularly after periods of significant conflict or economic upheaval. The Russell Napier piece really highlighted the parallels with post-WWII Europe, a period we seem to be echoing today.
Exactly. And Napier emphasized that investors spend far too much time chasing the right answers rather than asking the right questions. In this case, the right question is, are we entering a period of financial repression? And if so, how should we adapt our investment strategies?
Precisely. And the key adaptation, according to Napier, is a shift towards value investing, specifically focusing on equities trading below a CAPE ratio of 10. Historically, that's yielded around 6.5% real returns over a 10-year period. It's a surprisingly simple yet powerful observation. It's almost as if the market's pricing mechanism, normally a continuous function, becomes discrete, abruptly shifting between states, much like a step function in calculus.
A step function, you say? Interesting. That's a good analogy, Alex. It implies a sudden, rather than gradual, change in market behavior. But isn't that a bit simplistic? Aren't there risks associated with solely focusing on low CAPE ratios?
Of course, it's not a magic bullet. It's a starting point. The point is to be mindful of the broader environment. And it's not just about CAPE ratios. Napier also pointed to overlooked sectors, smaller cap companies, and value stocks generally. Those tend to get squeezed in a low-rate environment, but they also offer significant upside when rates normalize.
So a contrarian approach. And what about the geopolitical elements? Napier suggested that geopolitical events should prompt deeper inquiry into the global monetary system. It's easy to get caught up in the headlines, but the real story is often happening beneath the surface.
Absolutely. The dollar's position as the global reserve currency is increasingly precarious, as highlighted in the Unhedged podcast. The gradual erosion of trust in the U.S., fueled by policy choices and even leadership statements, is contributing to a weakening dollar. This creates volatility, but also opportunities for those willing to look beyond the dominant narrative.
And that's where gold comes into play, right? As a potential hedge against inflation and restricted capital movement. But many see gold as a relic of the past.
It's a cyclical asset. It performs best during periods of uncertainty and currency debasement. And we're arguably entering such a period. More broadly, it's about understanding that established frameworks become obsolete during regime shifts. The traditional economic education, particularly in Europe, is inadequate, relying too heavily on mathematical models disconnected from real-world application.
The journal piece on Howard Rubin really underscored that disconnect. The ability to compartmentalize, to maintain a respectable public persona while allegedly engaging in deeply unethical behavior. It speaks to a larger issue within elite financial circles, a tolerance for risk-taking that extends far beyond the purely financial.
A disturbing observation indeed. It reinforces the need for a more holistic approach to risk management, extending beyond just financial metrics. And the Rubin case also highlights the power of NDAs, a legal tool that can be exploited to silence victims and protect perpetrators.
Let's bring it back to investing. The We Study Billionaires podcast emphasized the importance of redefining wealth beyond just financial stability, incorporating time, social connections, mental clarity, and physical health. How does that fit into this picture of financial repression?
It's about recognizing that financial repression isn't just an economic phenomenon, it's a societal one. It reflects a broader trend of governments intervening in the economy to achieve specific goals, often at the expense of individual freedom and prosperity. Diversification becomes even more crucial in such an environment, as emphasized by PIMCO exposure to agency mortgages, securitized credit, and emerging markets.
And what about the potential for a slow, agonizing decline in equity valuations, as Napier predicted? 1966-1982 or 1919-20 style correction?
That's the most likely scenario, driven by higher interest rates rather than a sudden crash. It's a gradual erosion of value, a painful realization that the easy money era is over. And that's where the value investing approach, with its focus on fundamental analysis and long-term horizons, becomes particularly relevant. It requires patience and discipline, but the rewards can be substantial.
So what's the key takeaway here? What should investors be doing right now?
Be wary of chasing yield, prioritize total return, and consider overlooked sectors. Maintain detailed investment diaries to track your reasoning, learn from past decisions, and be open to unconventional strategies. And remember, even in overvalued markets, opportunities exist, particularly in smaller cap value stocks. The MSCI China Index, despite decades of GDP growth, remains below its peak, a stark reminder that economic growth doesn't automatically translate to positive equity performance. It's a counterintuitive truth that often gets lost in the noise.
That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. A combination of historical awareness, contrarian thinking, and a willingness to embrace uncertainty. It's a challenging environment, but also a potentially rewarding one for those who are prepared. So let's dive into a topic that's increasingly dominating headlines and investor sentiment, big tech scrutiny and market power. It feels like we've reached a critical inflection point. Alex, your initial thoughts?
Well, Maya, it's undeniable. The sheer scale of these companies, collectively controlling 40% of the S&P 500, is staggering. It's a concentration of economic power unlike anything we've seen in recent history. In the recent discussions around potential consumer strikes, targeting companies like Amazon, Apple, Disney, Google, and Meta highlight the growing frustration. It's almost as if the market itself is starting to recognize the vulnerability.
Exactly. The idea of a coordinated resist and unsubscribe campaign, as they're calling it, is fascinating. It's a novel framing of consumer activism, predicated on their high valuations and sensitivity to growth slowdowns. Is this a viable strategy or just performative posturing?
I think it has more potential than people realize. The pivot piece emphasized sustained, scaled-back consumerism, even at 70-80% reduction, would be far more impactful than fleeting all-or-nothing boycotts. It's a slow burn, but sustained pressure can be remarkably effective. We're essentially seeing a reevaluation of the power of individual economic restraint in a capitalist system.
And it's not just about economic pressure, is it? The discussion around the social media's impact on mental health, especially among teens, is deeply concerning. The comparison to harmful substances is chilling. The legal trials emerging now, they're analogous to the big tobacco era, aren't they? Executives seemingly aware of the addictive nature and its consequences.
Precisely. And the ethical dimensions extend beyond just user well-being. Investment firms Vanguard, BlackRock, Fidelity, holding substantial shares in companies involved in ICE detention facilities. It's a stark reminder of how deeply intertwined these tech giants are with complex and often morally questionable systems. It's a systemic entanglement.
It's almost like a cautionary tale drawn from history. The connection they made to Hitler's rise, highlighting corporate enablement of authoritarian regimes, it's a heavy comparison, but the underlying point is potent. Prioritizing shareholder value above all else can have devastating consequences.
Indeed, it's a chilling parallel. And thinking about this in terms of information organization, which is my field, you could say that big tech has effectively created a vast, interconnected card catalog of our lives. But instead of facilitating access to knowledge, it's increasingly used to curate echo chambers and manipulate behavior, effectively controlling the flow of information and shaping our perceptions. The system designed to organize has become an instrument of control.
That's remarkably insightful, Alex. A very apt metaphor. So let's shift gears slightly. Beyond consumer boycotts, what about regulatory intervention? Do you see governments stepping up to break up these companies or impose stricter controls?
I think it's inevitable, though the timeline is uncertain. The Alex Freddy case and Secretary Noem's response, that's a worrying example of government overreach. It's creating a climate of distrust and undermining fundamental rights. It's also highlighting the need for better strategic communication, as underscored by Apple's recent PR missteps. Tim Cook's actions are in essence damaging his legacy, a strategic misstep akin to Bob Iger's later career.
Absolutely. And the potential for Congress to hold the Fed accountable, Daniel Moss pointed that out, it's a crucial lever. Even a war-led Fed might be constrained by congressional oversight.
Precisely. And the increasing value of social connections, even synthetic ones, is becoming recognized as a critical component of both mental and physical health. This shift in emphasis will likely reshape how we view the impact of these platforms.
So what's the prediction? What's the one thing we should be watching most closely in the next 6 months regarding big tech?
I think the trajectory of the AI investment within Amazon is crucial. The shift towards automation, where headcount remains flat despite revenue growth, is a fundamental change in business model, a sort of corporate Ozempic, if you will. It signals a ruthless efficiency drive and a potential disruption to the labor market that could amplify existing social tensions.
That's a powerful image. So the bottom line here is that big tech's dominance is facing unprecedented scrutiny, driven by a combination of consumer activism, regulatory pressure, and growing ethical concerns. And the market itself is beginning to recognize that vulnerability.
Exactly. And the ability to translate that awareness into meaningful change will depend on a sustained, multifaceted approach, one that combines individual economic restraint with robust political engagement and a renewed focus on ethical considerations. That's where we are with this topic right now.
So now moving on to our next topic, geopolitical realignment and U.S. decline. It feels like the old certainties are crumbling. Alex, are we witnessing a genuine rupture in the global order, as Adam Tooze suggests, or just a particularly nasty economic cycle?
Well, Maya, I think rupture is apt. It's not a smooth transition, it's a jarring of tectonic plates. The sheer scale of China's infrastructure and green tech development, exceeding American capabilities, highlights a fundamental shift. It's not just about catching up, they're forging ahead in areas critical to future dominance.
And it's not just China. The multipolar world is burgeoning. 30 to 40 competent nation-state players, as Tooze pointed out, that's a vastly different strategic landscape than the unipolar moment. Are we seeing a coordinated effort or just a proliferation of independent ordering attempts, as he puts it?
It's largely the latter, I think. The unifying factor, surprisingly, isn't ideology but a shared historical trauma, stemming from the collapse of the Soviet Union. Both Russia and China view that as a catastrophic failure and are wary of repeating it. It's a deep-seated fear of historical nihilism, as the Chinese put it, rejecting their own history.
Right. And the Biden administration's attempts to reassert American liberal hegemony, let's just say they haven't exactly been stellar. The focus on a democracies versus authoritarians framing feels increasingly simplistic and frankly counterproductive. It obscures the complex incentives at play.
Precisely. It's a fundamentally flawed framework. It defines the world negatively, grouping disparate actors based on their difference from the U.S., rather than shared interests. It's like trying to solve a crime by only focusing on who isn't the suspect. It's a flawed methodology, much like a forensic investigator who ignores crucial evidence because it doesn't fit their preconceived theory.
That's a brilliant analogy, Alex. The EU-India trade deal, for example, seems to be operating independently of that framework, doesn't it? A pragmatic move for both sides to secure their trade interests, regardless of Washington's perspective.
Absolutely. And Srividya Jandiala's work highlights how companies are moving from event-based responses to a structural understanding of geopolitical risk. They're recognizing the long-tail effects, the systemic shifts that reshape dependencies far beyond immediate supply chain disruptions.
Speaking of systemic shifts, the rise of China's debt-based development programs, as Jandiala noted, is a significant departure from traditional aid. It's a more nuanced form of influence and one that Western analyses often overlook. My prediction is that we'll see more countries actively seeking these types of partnerships, further eroding the traditional Western-led development model.
I agree. And consider the implications for AI. Geopolitical factors are now fundamentally reshaping that landscape: access to chips, data storage, foundational models. It's no longer just about technological innovation, it's about national security, and companies are having to relocate, localize, and adapt accordingly.
Exactly. And the Senate's historic reluctance to embrace climate treaties, stemming from concerns about China's exemptions, highlights a long-standing tension, the interplay between domestic politics and global economic competition. A tension that's only intensifying now.
That's right. And looking forward, I anticipate a continued fragmentation of the global order, with multiple competing ordering attempts, rather than a return to a single dominant power. The era of American hegemony is, in essence, over.
So the bottom line here is that we're entering a period of unprecedented complexity and uncertainty. A world where agility, adaptability, and a willingness to abandon outdated assumptions will be the keys to survival. That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. So let's dive into something fascinating: the potential for a commodity supercycle heavily influenced by geopolitical drivers. It's not just about economic growth anymore, is it?
No, absolutely not. What's striking is the confluence of factors. We're seeing de-dollarization pressures, emerging markets stockpiling commodities, and a unique surge in demand from hyperscalers, all acting in concert. It's a truly novel situation.
Novel indeed. Jeff Curry pointed out that the simultaneous rise in gold, silver, and copper is defying traditional economic signals. It's almost as if hoarding and asset diversification are outweighing standard growth indicators.
Precisely. And it's not solely cyclical. Policy decisions are the real engine here. Think about the 9 trillion euros in defense spending slated for the next decade, alongside electrification and, of course, the ongoing wealth redistribution efforts. It's a policy-driven cycle echoing the 60s and 2000s.
The bottleneck with critical minerals is also compelling. China's dominance in processing, largely due to historical NIMBY concerns, creates a huge hurdle for onshoring. We're essentially dependent on a single point of control.
That's right. And the biggest constraint right now isn't actually supply and demand, it's capital investment. It's like trying to restore a classic car. You have the chassis, the engine, even some of the body panels. But finding the right skilled mechanics and sourcing those rare, irreplaceable parts is the real challenge. Capital's stuck in asset-light sectors, creating volatility.
A fantastic analogy. And let's not forget the central banks diversifying out of Western bonds. That's a significant demand driver. Could we see a substantial price correction as capital rotates back into commodities?
It's certainly possible, and the market is significantly underweight, creating that potential. However, even a collapse in Chinese property, which is already being felt, is unlikely to negate the broader supercycle. It might delay it, but not derail it.
Justin Hoon highlighted the potential for tech companies to directly secure uranium offtakes, mirroring their copper deals. That's a fascinating catalyst we shouldn't overlook. And the shift in utility behavior towards smaller, more frequent RFPs, that's a clear sign of tightening supply.
Absolutely. And we're seeing producers adopting a Trump-style negotiating tactic, demanding market reference contracts. It signals a significant power shift.
So if this continues, what do we predict? I'm thinking we'll see sustained price spikes rather than a steady upward trend. A bubbling cauldron, as Jeff Curry put it.
I agree. My prediction is that we'll continue to see volatility, but the underlying demand fundamentals driven by these policy and geopolitical shifts will ultimately push prices higher. The real question becomes, can supply respond quickly enough to meet the escalating demand?
A crucial question indeed. It seems the supercycle's duration will be extended due to delayed supply responses. It's certainly a complex landscape to navigate. It will be crucial to watch how central banks and tech companies interact with the evolving commodity market. So as we wrap up tonight, it's striking how these seemingly disparate threads, AI disruption, financial repression, big tech scrutiny, geopolitical realignment, and a potential commodity supercycle, weave together into a remarkably consistent narrative. It's not simply a collection of isolated events, but a systemic reordering, a shift in the very foundations of our economic and political landscape. What connects them all, Alex, is a profound erosion of trust, trust in institutions and markets, and even in the narratives we've been told.
Precisely. And that erosion isn't linear. It's fractal, manifesting at different scales, from the individual investor questioning inflated tech valuations to nation-states diversifying away from the dollar. If I were to draw an analogy from classical architecture, it would be to the Pantheon in Rome. Initially conceived as a temple to all gods, it evolved over time, its oculus, that singular circular opening to the heavens, becoming a symbol of both enlightenment and vulnerability. Similarly, our global system, once perceived as a monolithic structure, is now revealing cracks and fissures, with these various forces acting as the sunlight streaming through, illuminating the underlying fragility.
That's a beautifully apt metaphor, Alex. the Pantheon embodying both strength and openness to change. And the idea of fragility is key. We've spent so much time focusing on the what, the specific disruptions, that we've neglected the why. The underlying cause seems to be a fundamental mismatch between the promises of globalization and the lived realities of many. The AI hype, the unchecked market power of big tech, the geopolitical tensions, they're all symptoms of a deeper malaise.
And it's a malaise that demands a recalibration of risk assessment. The era of easy money and unquestioned growth is demonstrably over. We're entering a phase of increased volatility, where conventional wisdom is likely to be overturned. The unsubscribed February scenario, the potential for a 50-80% correction in AI-driven tech companies, the diversification away from US assets, these aren't fringe scenarios anymore, they're increasingly probable outcomes.
So where does this leave the investor? The recommendations we've touched on tonight, focusing on value investing, particularly smaller cap stocks, and considering overlooked sectors, offer a pragmatic path forward. But more importantly, it demands a shift in mindset. A willingness to question assumptions, to embrace uncertainty, and to prioritize long-term resilience over short-term gains.
Indeed. And the geopolitical element cannot be ignored. The slow, agonizing decline Napier predicted, echoing historical precedents like the 1966-1982 correction, will likely be driven by policy choices and shifting power dynamics rather than a sudden market crash. That requires a different kind of preparedness, an understanding that the game has changed and that the old rules no longer apply.
It's a challenging environment, certainly, but also one ripe with opportunity for those who are willing to adapt. It requires a level of intellectual humility, a recognition that we're navigating uncharted territory. And perhaps a little bit of courage to look beyond the headlines and ask the truly difficult questions.
Precisely. The Pantheon's oculus continues to illuminate, revealing both the beauty and the vulnerability of the structure. It's a reminder that even the most enduring institutions are subject to the forces of change.
Well said, Alex. Thank you for your always insightful perspective. And thank you for joining us on the Daily Digest. We'll be back tomorrow with more analysis and insights. Until then, stay informed, stay vigilant, and stay curious.